Welcome to False Bottom Girls, a podcast about the wonderful yet sometimes confusing world of beer and brewing.
Hi, I'm Rachel Hudson, owner of Pilot Brewing and an advanced cicerone.
Hi, I'm Jen Blair, sensory expert, homebrewer, and advanced cicerone. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of False Bottom Girls. I am Jen.
I am Rachel.
And today we have somebody special. It's our first repeat guest. We have Frances T.G. Wong from Firmly. Frances, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, thank you for being here again. And I think you really are the first person we've had on twice. So you've got something of like a celebrity status. You're part of our canon now in the lore of False Bottom Girls.
What is my origin story? Thank you for having me. I'm just really excited to talk about pasteurization and really dive into food safety because it's not something that's talked about much in the industry, or if it is, it's still kind of people are asking for it, but they don't want to admit that they need it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like talking about money. It's like, I need it, but I don't want to talk about it.
Right. Right. And I think that's a really good analogy. And admittedly, I mean, I know kind of like a textbook amount about pasteurization, but for me, pasteurization, knowing about it was really like, what do I need to know for the Master Cicerone exam, as opposed to what do I need to know as somebody who's making a product that I'm selling to people and, you know, need for it to be safe. And I think especially like what we're seeing with like the NA beers and things like that, I know that's come up a lot. And do you think, in your opinion, as a TTB chemist, what you've been seeing in the industry, does it seem like more craft brewers are now being interested in pasteurization? Because I always kind of thought like pasteurization was something that the big guys did, and they did it for, you know, shelf stability, and that was kind of it. Are you seeing more of like the interest coming from the craft side?
I mean, there's a lot of people trying to find a way into the non-alcoholic realm, and that's great. I mean, I'm a huge supporter of it. I definitely do sober months, and I want those beers to be really, really good, and I don't want to get sick,
right.
Which is just like, frankly, I think that kind of like in the needs, like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, need to get sick is pretty much in there before you get like, to self-actualization, because you don't want to have that experience. But with breweries trying to find a way to get into this market, it's presented some challenges that, frankly, a lot of people didn't really want to admit were much larger challenges that kind of we got to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
Because beer has alcohol, it has a low pH, it has hops, it has all these wonderful things that prevents things from growing. But when you start messing with one of those, you're going to have a different challenge presented.
Mm-hmm.
And so people trying to figure out how can I get a little pie of a bit of this pie of non-alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a huge challenge for people because they have to actually start looking at other parts of their process that they never really had to. And a very significant part of it is frankly cleaning, because there's people that frankly, and breweries that I've been in, that they do not have great cleaning practices. And it's because they are able to rely on those three factors of alcohol, mm-hmm. pH, and isoalpha acids to just address that problem.
Right.
And once you remove, and we're removing alcohol, then we're presenting a wonderful opportunity for things to grow. Especially since there's, you know, arrested fermentation, there's vacuum distillation, there's all of these different processes. There's frankly blending. That's what mm-hmm. a lot of other places do, is like they brew a regular beer and then they're just adding deaerated water, which is a great idea. I mean, it's efficient, but I mean, I think something that everyone is presented with as a really good example of how well do you think you know your process is draft lines. Like, how clean are draft lines? How mm-hmm. clean can you get them? And can you get them clean enough to feel safe to put a non-alcoholic product on draft? And we're seeing this It's okay with hop waters. Like I have seen some coliforms in hop waters,
Ooh.
but yeah, it's people don't want to believe it, but it's like it happens. It does happen. And people do put those on draft, but that has a I'm a little bit less worried because you don't have a bunch of additional sugars in there for things to chow down on.
Right.
So I think like we should when before we dive into a little bit more, just for our listeners, kind of just do a brief overview of like what pasteurization is, you know, why what we're talking about right now is so important to making sure that you are pasteurizing these products, just to give them a little clarification.
Yeah, so pasteurization is basically it's heat treatment. If you go to the grocery store and you buy orange juice or milk or anything like that, or frankly, if you have had a baby, chances are you were told to not eat unpasteurized cheese. It's a process to make something basically safe to eat. And the origin of the name comes from Louis Pasteur. He was in France. There's this entire thing about how the Germans invaded, and because he lost his opportunity to have a lab because, you know, a war happened, he decided to mess with the Germans because he didn't like all these German import beers. So he's like, I'm going to help the French brewers have better quality beers because it'll be more shelf stable. So, basically, part of the reason why we have pasteurization at all is because Louis Pasteur got really annoyed that he didn't get his lab. And what happens when you piss off a scientist is that they're going to find a way to use science against you. and that's exactly what he did. So you ended up with more shelf stable beers, and that's why we call it pasteurization, is because he did basically rediscover it or learn to apply it to brewing specifically. But it's re really important to keep in mind that heat treatment is not a new thing. Actually, it's a very old, age-old practice. You can go all the way back to Japan. I believe there's documents from the 1500s. There's some that are much older that a monk was actually describing how he did heat treatment. And that's a process called hiire. And that means put into the fire. And that is the Japanese name for pasteurization. And so, sake, you have to remember that they have sake, they have kimchi, they have natto, they have so many different fermented foods. They have so many things that can go wrong. And a lot of those fermented foods are absolutely necessary to, you know, keep the. It, a lot of that had to do with making sure that the population was healthy because fermentation provides so many important nutrients and can create wonderful, amazing things. And frankly, alcohol's a really fun thing. So I don't know. Just a theory. Just a theory. Maybe we've just been doing this ever since we realized our own existence and we just want to escape it.
So true.
but. So,
Humanity says, thanks, I hate it, and then we start drinking.
it's like that actually came up in a book that I was reading called Alcohol and Humans was like basically we realized and we became self-aware and immediately learned how to ex
Not me. Dull that emotion.
I don't like this is uncomfortable. So just so it's really so heat treatment can be a couple of different things. In pasteurization, we use heat exchangers, and that's when basically the product is put through a tube and it's gradually heated up and it's heated up really quickly and then cooled down really quickly. And heat exchangers are basically, I don't know, they look like corrugated cardboard, but like you put a bunch of them together and all of that creates more surface area to be able to superheat something or supercool something down at a very, very efficiently. The other one that we see a lot is tunnel pasteurization. And you will usually see this on a product if they if it was flash pasteurized or tunnel pasteurized. So tunnel pasteurization is basically that you're putting it through the tunnel of no love for microbes. And you're just gradually heating it up because we have to remember that beer and a lot of other beverages are carbonated. And what happens when you heat something up too fast? It tends to not stay in the thing that it was in. So heats it up slowly and then maintains it at a temperature and then gradually cools it down. And that's using water. And I can go into the fluid dynamics of like how fluids move around, but we don't need to do that.
That
I
will
don't
be
know.
when we have you back for a third time.
I know because it's just so much fun to talk about this.
My
And so,
master Cicero of study self is like, do it, talk about it. Just kidding.
Well, I think there's also some misconceptions as to what pasteurization's goal is. And people often miss this, is that it's not to get things sterile. It's not to kill off everything. It's to achieve practical sterility, which is basically, killing off some microorganisms can grow, but not at temperatures high enough to kill all of the other organisms. Like you have very specific things that you want to have not exist. But if you wanted to kill everything that, frankly, you encounter in a beverage, it's really unlikely. As someone that has done lots of plating, I've done plating on post-pasteur beers that have been pasteurized and things like that. And you will still get like these spore-forming bacteria, but they're non-toxic. They're not an issue for us. And frankly, one of my favorite discussions in college was the most unfortunate thing that can ever happen to most bacteria is to encounter a human because we are really efficient at killing things. It's fact of the matter.
Right.
And you can take that and apply that to so many other things aside from bacteria, but we're just going to stay focused on this. So you have that opportunity to really get things addressed. And when we talk about pathogens and preventing those, we're talking about Listeria, Salmonella, E. coli. Those are the typical things that you are going to encounter in, frankly, most beverages or food that can be very problematic if you get it. And our goal is to just kill those off and possibly and also kill off the yeast because you don't want re-fermentation because that's how you make things go boom. So it's such an important aspect of making something food safe. And people kind of want to get and move around it because frankly, it can be very energy intense, financially intense. A flash pasteurizer doesn't take up a lot of space, but then you have to consider that after that, it has to go through hoses and it has to go through a canning line. And canning lines also can be notoriously dirty or not very clean. And that's also an issue because you still have the cleaning problems that if you don't have a good SOP, standard operating procedure, then you're going to have bigger issues. And those issues will come out in a non-alcoholic product. So by brewing a non-alcoholic product before you're actually ready, you're kind of whistleblowing on yourself.
No, that makes total sense. Also, I have to say that I think practical sterility sounds like a similar concept to like California sober. Like it's like, yeah, I sterilize, but I don't sterilize everything.
It's close enough. It's I so I mean like but people want to try other things, so they want to try preservatives. But the problem is that if you use some preservatives like potassium sorbate, you can't sell your beverage in Whole Foods. It's on there like, no, we're not going to deal with that. We are all natural. We still give our money to Jeff Bezos. It's all the same, but if you're trying to go with that, like we're all natural, we're healthy, we want to distribute here because frankly, you're international and this is a really great opportunity. That's something that you have to consider. And pasteurization is a way to not have to worry about that. Like, oh, don't worry, our product's pasteurized. Yay. Another way that people are trying to get around it is by doing, there's a new thing on this chitosan fibers in from a mushroom called Kyber. And that is being researched a lot in terms of how effective it is and applying that to all of this and as an alternative that you can do. And then we have other people that are like, oh, well, I'm just going to do Velcurin. And Velcurin's really kind of not great. It's great for your product because it disrupts cell walls, basically. It's not cell walls. Cell membranes. Sorry. Cell walls are plants. and the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
That's right. We know that because of you.
It's like the one thing everybody remembers from high school or middle school. At least me.
Well, I think it's just really kind of funny that mitochondrial DNA usually comes from the mother. So if you think about it, it's a female powerhouse.
I mean, naturally. Of course. Yeah.
Naturally.
So so it disrupts basically the way that the cells operate. And so, frankly, it's really great. But in order to use it, it's extremely toxic. You have to have it specially delivered. It is a gas, which means you have to consider how are you going to contain a gas and how are you going to deliver this into your product? And there is an entire complicated system. And then you can't, and then frankly, that product needs to go and sit somewhere while the Velcurin gets into the fluid, because frankly, while it's a gas and while it's still toxic, it can kill you. It'll melt your lungs. So,
oh, wow.
And people are like, oh, well, maybe I'll just do this cool Velcurin thing. It sounds like it solves all of my problems. And it's like, yeah, but you need to also consider your staff and how you're setting up. I mean, tunnel pasteurization, it's a big footprint. I get it. It's frustrating, but you're just dealing with water and things getting hot. We are very familiar with that. What we are not familiar with, and what most people aren't used to in this industry, is frankly a super toxic gas. Right. Carbon dioxide, we know, like, there's people that are like, yeah, I can smell it. So I like to go over, I push it down on one nostril, and then I lean over and I smell it, and then I turn off the purge. And it's like, that's not, miss something. Yeah.
I've had people tell me that before too. Like, yeah. Or we could just use this little machine that I have that will tell you the exact number when you stick it up in the port where it's coming out instead of your nose.
Yeah. Oh, so convenient. But yeah, so Velcurin, super cool, but it's not necessarily, is it going to be financially cheaper than tunnel pasteurization? Mm-hmm. Probably not. Is it going to be harder for your staff to deal with? Yes. And also, you can't drink those beverages off the line. So you need to have signs everywhere because you know somebody's going to.
Right.
And especially if you are the way that some breweries, I hope more breweries have kind of moved away from using volunteers for canning. But let's be honest, we occasionally have a family friend or somebody that wants to come in and they want to feel like they're part of the team. And they go and do that, and then they're so excited about low fills, and they just want to take it, and they just want to take that low fill and have a good gulp, and it's just oh no.
Yeah,
sorry, Jerry. So when we talk, so pasteurization then seems like it's pretty cool when you have all of these other things that you need to consider. They're great and they're options. Some of them are better than others. Some of them are more financially feasible than others, but they all have their limitations. And pasteurization is something that we've had around for frankly centuries, possibly right. millennia, if we really try and go far enough back, because frankly, it only takes so many people getting killed before you dying before you start figuring out maybe if we heat things up.
Right. Yes, and I love that. And that's one of the things and I know, Francis, you've always got like so many research projects that you have going on, which I absolutely love. And I also super love that your research doesn't only focus on, well, it's called pasteurization because of Louis Pasteur. Louis Pasteur is the only person in the world who's ever thought about this, and like you take the time to go beyond that and look in other cultures and look at other like scientific data that exists to say like, okay, yeah, this might be named after this guy in like Euro-colonial society, but that doesn't make that like the only person, right? He's not the only go-to source. And I love that about your research, because I'll just, randomly get texts that are like, here's some hydrometer facts that I just learned. And it's like, yes, I'm here for the hydrometer facts. So when we're talking about pasteurization, I know that you've also done some research on the flavor impacts that pasteurization can have on beers. Can you tell us, like, what some of those are the flavor impacts? As I don't know, I guess for me and my research, you know, I've again, you know, being more from the craft point of view is like, oh, well, pasteurization is going to strip away all of your flavor. It's going to do all of this stuff. And it's just going to make your, you know, like your craft beer not taste as good. And like that's fine for industrial beer where you're going for a very low flavor profile, you know, very consistent flavor profile. So how founded are those fears that pasteurization can just kind of like completely change the flavor of your finished product?
Yeah, well, I think it to really kind of go back, it used to be a lot of the macro breweries that were using pasteurization that had access to, frankly, the funds
Right.
and the space to have pasteurization. And a lot of let's also consider a lot of them produce a lot of light lagers. These beers are extremely durable for a reason. They
Right.
travel well. They don't have a lot going on inside them. It's ooh, I just had some bad ideas and I'm not going to say them out loud. I don't want to offend anyone quite yet. It's still early. But these beers were very resilient. They had a low bitterness. They had reasonable alcohol. They have a decent pH. So they were pretty good. They could handle a lot. The problem is when non-alcoholics and what we're doing now is we're looking at pasteurizing IPAs and these double dry hopped and triple dry hopped because people are like, we still want to pack in that bitterness, that flavor. So then it's not as malty sweet as we've kind of begun to notice. I'm sure a lot of you have done tried a non-alcoholic beer. And the biggest thing that people say is usually like it's kind of malty. It's a little bit, it tastes.
It's warty, yeah.
Yeah, it's and I mean like you keep actually the technical MB in the Master Brewers Association and their technical quarterly, they have a paper that they did that someone did that is an approach to sensory analysis of non-alcoholic beers. And they literally did a word cloud of the descriptions for non-alcoholic beers. And it's just malty and warty or thin or dry. I mean, like, so you're trying to pack in all these hops because you want something else. You want
Right.
a different flavor. You want something reminiscent of the beer that it's supposed to be like a little mimic of. And frankly, hops are not isoalpha acids, the thing that makes it bitter. They aren't very heat resistant. They're called isoalpha acids, and that means that they can be isomerized, basically broken down into something that doesn't taste the same.
Right.
And so you're losing this huge flavor component. And so, yeah, I mean, I literally heard a retired brewer yell at someone like, yeah, just crank it to 70 pasteurization units, which is this ephemeral concept of calculations that. That just crank it up and just send it through and it'll be fine. And it's like, no, it won't. That process is no longer applicable because we have something so much more complicated. And when you're worried about flavor breakdown, it's going to change a lot. I mean, it's like sitting there and telling somebody like, oh, tomatoes are going to taste the same after you boil them. They're not.
Yeah,
You have pasta sauce, it changes.
right.
It's potatoes. A great example of it is broccoli, because broccoli is a really interesting one because it has glucosinolates, and those can be a huge problem if you have too much of those. But cooking it removes those as a problem. They break down.
Right.
So cooking things is a great thing. It changes things from, yeah, it could be a problem to not a problem. Great. But the problem is we're removing, we are creating a new problem of the flavor changes. So should you be cranking it to 70 pasteurization units when frankly, Saccharomyces is usually killed at 2?
Wow.
And like, why are you doing this? Why are you purposely torching your product? Why are you your if you're trying to be reminiscent of something, then why are you putting it, and you're putting it through a process that frankly that product doesn't go through, then
Right.
you're calling that the alcoholic product doesn't go through, then you really are setting yourself up for a lot of failure because you're not completely accounting for the changes that can happen. And I really want us to all have safe products, but frankly, I want to also want to drink it.
Right.
And that's a huge problem. If it's not good, I don't want to drink it.
Right.
And that's something that like people need to consider. And when I have people ask me, when I talk to people about drinking non-alcoholic beer instead of alcoholic beer, the way I describe it is think of it kind of like becoming vegetarian. If you're trying to find something that's exactly like meat, you're not going to find it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes,
It's like,
that's an excellent analogy.
yeah, because it's just like, are you going to find something that's perfectly the same as meat? With and it's like with gluten free, we're getting close, we're getting close, we're getting there, we're figuring out that there's a lot
Right.
of other options out there, but it's still not the same. And you see people still reluctant to use gluten free alternatives because it's just doesn't behave the same way. So when we talk about non-alcoholic beer and the flavor profile, it's like, yeah, that's actually the most important aspect of it is that experience. And that's what's going to keep people coming back and drinking it.
Right. So what are I guess what are some of the like potential flavor impacts that pasteurization can have? Like I know I think I've read before like it can have like a cooked flavor. And honestly, like I've never done a side by side of something like pasteurized versus non-pasteurized to see for myself if there is a tangible difference or if it's kind of like I know that I'm tasting a beer that's been pasteurized, so now I can infer these descriptors onto it.
Yeah.
So, like, what are some of the flavor impacts that it can have? Rachel,
I
what are some of the flavor impacts that pasteurization can have on finished beer?
can tell you exactly
Okay.
in a second. I have these notes.
Also, let's keep in mind that not all pasteurization is going to result in the same impact either, because
Oh, no, for sure.
doing tunnel pasteurization, you're holding something at a temperature for a long period of time. And
Okay.
that's to absolutely like that's going to probably have a bigger impact on it. But to quote my paper, like tunnel pasteurization, it's a silver bullet to microbes, but a possible stake to the heart of your brand standards. And I'm sorry I didn't include enough cryptozoology in an official white paper. That, specifically tunnel pasteurization is that challenge because you're having it at that higher temperature. At the same time that I was doing that experiment, I believe Allie up at New Belgium was studying flash pasteurization and its impact on IPAs, and they didn't notice any change in the flavor profiles, which is great because it's like, okay, well, then flash pasteurization is great for those, but you're also doing alcoholic drinks, and how is that going to further impact a non-alcoholic drink? And then what are the considerations that we need to have for afterwards?
So the data that he provided us with his experiment, it's beer. I don't have any notes of what type, but it basically had a decrease of everything from malty biscuity, burnt sugar, banana, passion fruit, popcorn. There's a decrease in like all these flavors lost. However, there was increases of, and this is based upon a 18 testers comparing si six samples and six separate replicated tests giving about 108 results.
Got it.
And then what was increased is boiled egg a sulfur aroma from H2S from 12% to 46%, vegetable oil aroma, drains, mercaptan, burnt rubber, and just various other thiols. So there's like a lot of increase in not so pleasant compounds here, and a little bit of decrease in some of the ones that seem a little bit more pleasant sometimes.
Yeah, and I wonder if that is And I don't remember if he addressed this in the class or not, Rachel, but when we're talking about people, like tasting panels and reporting decreases in, like increases in kind of some of these less desirable flavors and, decreases
Well,
in like more desirable flavors,
yeah.
if the kind of the decrease in like the desirable flavors, the ones that people are used to getting in beer, like malty biscuity, passion fruit, all of that, if that decrease is what's leading to the increased perception in those other, in like the
Yeah, possibly. Oh,
non-desirable.
yeah, for sure. Like it's all so they use the check all that apply test. So the what's the word I'm missing here? The taste testers. We just went through, and basically just checked all that applied with what they were tasting. So it wasn't like go back and forth, like this one is unpasteurized and this one is, and let me do a decrease increase, which I know is not what you're saying, but just to clarify. But yeah, that's very possible. Like, of course, you might taste more of other things because you're tasting less of something else.
And it's that way with phenols, it's like the
Oh, yeah.
perception, like phenols are kind of like a straight line throughout, but it's how everything else changes that affects how you perceive them. So I'm just curious if, and I know we have no way of knowing. I don't think, Francis, you're the science one here. So maybe
Yeah.
you do know and we don't know. But I always just wonder, we particularly like you're not using like a GCMS, right? You're using people, and so or is the perception increase of one thing because the other thing decreased, or is it like, yes, this did decrease, and yes, this did increase.
Oh yeah, well, this is totally just a sensory side of it. So yeah, scientifically, like you said, Francis is the science person.
Francis is the science.
But something I do want to point out, and people tend to forget about this because when they're like, oh, we can use science to understand this better. And it's like, you know what? You could have all of the science in the world, but it doesn't matter if you're not making a good product in the
That's
first
an
place.
yeah, that's an excellent point.
Because I mean, honestly, like, people are like, well, it was clean and there was none of these micro issues. And it's like, yeah, but how did it taste? Like, will actually think of it. And so I always get kind of concerned when people just lean so heavily on like, oh no, I'm going to get this right. And it's like, yeah, but you're going to forget about all of this. I understand that you want to have diacetyl tested because you want to tell that one person that walked into your tap room and said that they taste diacetyl and you want to tell them to and you want to slap them with a science stick. I get it. I get it. But
Science stick.
technical term.
It.
But it's just, all of these flavors do change. They're going to change. Like we said, anytime you cook something, it's going to change. So, trying to understand that, and frankly, we don't need to really do much more research if we don't want to. You don't have to do much because we already know that it happens. So how can you be better about not causing it? That's literally like, okay, we understand how it happens. Now, how do we do prevention? And most people kind of skip the prevention part and they're just like, oops.
And just to be clear too, for our listeners, like for breweries who are making a clear alcoholic product, that this is a beer, this is just kind of a personal preference, don't really have to do this, but there are some industries and now breweries as well making alcohol-free beer. Or non-alcoholic, or and then even cideries, they need to do this. So there are like real, like just because it has alcohol in it, like a cider, doesn't mean it's safe. One, like there are real reasons why you have to do this. Like if you walk into like your small craft nano brewery, microbrewery, and you try to give them a hard time about not pasteurizing, that's not going to work. That's not what we're like passionate about on the safety side. We're talking about these nowadays it is, we've heard stories from people like breweries making a alcohol-free product or non-alcohol product and re-fermentation starting in the can because they didn't get it right. alcohol to kill the bacteria that did survive in there. So it causes like real issues. I just wanted to point that out for the listeners. Like, so it's okay if a brewery doesn't pasteurize their beer. You know, there's a lot of reasons big breweries do, and especially for the longevity of shelf life. And that's really what it's about in a brewery sense. So it's a little bit of that give and take with that flavor profile. But you know, down the road we have a local cidery. They're small, and they, you know, I don't know, 30 barrel batches, 40 barrel batches, and they can up some of their cider, and then they have a way to pasteurize their cans in kind of a batch style way. So there are very small, unique systems that you can, as long as you're doing it, there's ways that you can do it. That would be a package pasteurization system. I mean, it's not like a big, huge canning line or facility or anything like that. It's probably like, poor guys, I don't know, a couple cases at
Yeah.
a
Well, and that's, I think that's also an excellent point, Rachel, because yeah, listening to this and like just thinking about pasteurization, I definitely don't want to give the idea that it's like, oh, if you go into your craft brewery and they're not pasteurizing, it's an issue, because it's absolutely not. Because like you, Rachel, as owner of Pilot, you don't probably want people to be drinking your beer a year from now. You want them to be
Oh,
drinking it
definitely
as
not.
soon as
I
possible
mean,
after they buy it. So like you said, like that's past something like shelf stability. Pasteurization for shelf stability is not something that most small craft brewers are going to prioritize, because they, it's not
that's
that you don't want
expensive. And
a shelf stable product, is that you're intending for your consumers to drink your small batches of beer much quicker. And you're
yeah,
also not
exactly.
shipping them, you know, to like Australia or something. As far as I know, like you can't find Pilot in, you know, like Lithuania.
One day, you never know.
It's like we're all it's really Pilot Brewing's world, and we're just lucky to live in it.
Yeah, we're all just flying in it.
Welcome to first class. Take your seat.
And so there, but people, the batch pasteurization, it I call it the dishwasher.
There you go.
In a lot of
Get it in
situations,
there.
it looks like that. It's either a cabinet or it's a thing that like it comes through, it goes down, and it does this process. I mean, like it's an accessible way, it's a fairly new way, and it's a way to do a small amount of pasteurization at
Yes.
a time, which is good, which is good. But it's also like, okay, well, what are you doing to kind of quality check that? And that you are actually achieving things, because I mean, if your hot water heater goes out, then you're going to be having a problem. And frankly, I know that there's a lot of different problems that can happen in a brewery. And I've definitely talked to people, ooh, that I talked to one brewery and they had a pasteurizer and they had to give it up because they couldn't brew, because they were using all of their water to run the pasteurizer. So the tank couldn't fill up fast enough
Oh, wow.
so that they could brew beer. So when you run into these limitations of where am I putting my resources, you're going to choose making a product, and then you're also going to sit there and be like, drink it as soon as possible. And frankly, most beers, regardless of if they're alcoholic or non-alcoholic, you probably shouldn't be keeping them for more than 6 months. You should probably getting rid of it. I mean, I just decided to, sometimes I get bored and I just, or, well, it's not so much bored. I forgot something and then it became a science project. which I think, like, I've known brewers to do that with some barrels. Is I had a non-alcoholic beer and I tried it 8 months after I had it, after I bought it. And it had a really bad lactobacillus infection.
Oh, wow.
But I know that this brewery pasteurizes, but even then, it's like, practical sterility is really just addressing the immediate concern, because you wait 8 months, anything can happen. And frankly, we should be also considering that, like, beer is food. How long do you leave stuff in your fridge? Because if you're eating your lettuce in a timely fashion, then you're not going to be dealing with a rotten head. Unless we're talking about like some other murder or kind of trophy,
Right.
then you might be coming across like, a gross, disgusting head. Pasteurization is just really a promise that it's not going to be a problem during that range of time.
Sure.
Frankly, anything can happen. We want to make sure that people don't get sick during that time. But oh gosh, I think in college, somebody took some food from the cafeteria and they brought it back to their dorm room. And then they ate it 3 days later and they got terribly ill. And then they tried to sue the school. And they're like, no, that food wasn't meant to be eaten 3 days from now and left out. It's not a Papa John's pizza.
It's not a McDonald's hamburger.
But then you come back and you're like, oh, well, I got sick. And it's like, yeah, from basically an expired product,
Right.
which is why date codes are frankly really important and more people need to remember to use those.
Right.
I think that pasteurization is a solution, but we're not going to, frankly, it's the responsibility of the brewery, the beverage producer, your contract brewer, your co-packer, whoever you want to call them. It's their job to make sure that that is a food safe product going out the door, and it is on the consumer to consume it in a reasonable amount of time and
Right.
setting those expectations.
Right. And that is an excellent point that yes, beer is food and you should treat it as such.
No, I'm just
So
going to hold on to this bottle of Bourbon County Stout. It's 10 years old, but I'm just waiting for the perfect moment. And it's like, dude, it's not a sticker. More anxiety about stickers and where to put them
Right.
than drinking a Goose Island barrel-aged Bourbon County Stout. Like,
10 years old, huh?
yeah, it's just like, what if I find somebody that I really want to share it with? I'm going to be so disappointed that I missed out on this opportunity. I mean, oh my God, what if I meet so and so or so and so or so and so and I fangirl and then I realize that I don't have the most perfect beer to share with?
Excellent. Well, Francis, I know that you also this a lot of this information you're sharing with us today was also recently published in the Technical Quarterly. Is that correct? The Master Brewers Association TQ?
Yeah, so they recently did one that was completely focused on non-alcoholic beers. So you'll see in there my paper on tunnel pasteurization. You'll see one on Kyber, which is those chitosan fibers. That's the mushroom preservative.
Okay.
The sensory analysis, tons of fun things. Also, I'm on food safety committee. And so I just, and it just went live, I think this past week. That there is a food safety bite because it's food on pasteurization. And then also I did one a few months back on process authorities and the concept of what a process authority is because frankly most people brewers like if I mention that to somebody they're going to be like what is that? And it's like oh well to put it very simply it's somebody with the knowledge and expertise to tell you whether or not you're pasteurizing your stuff correctly and whether or not your food is safe. And it's a little bit troubling and a super interesting kind of squishy fun way is that so the Food and Drug Administration defines process authorities in this way. But they don't actually certify anybody. They just kind of are like, this is the general concept of a food state of a process authority.
Okay.
And yeah, good luck, guys.
Wow.
Yeah,
Kind of like life coach.
and it's just like
there you go.
life coach. And so it's like, so I mean, I'm part of the Association of Food and Drug Officials, but even then, they're like, well, you need to demonstrate all of these other things. And it's like there are people because these process authorities they specialize in fermented things, kimchi, sauerkraut, like all the fun stuff, as well as beers and things like that. But beer
Right.
is still a very new one, and it's something that there isn't a lot of people that specifically can speak to pasteurization and its impact on beer because we've been pasteurizing milk and orange juice and all of these other fermented foods and
Mm-hmm.
non-fermented foods, frankly, things that come from a natural source, and we know that sometimes things happen, like E. coli and spinach,
Right.
that, there's already a standardized practice for how to address these things. We're really just now diving into beer, even though Louis Pasteur invented this for beer or raised
Right.
it for beer, and now we're actually understanding it, and it's because so much has changed in the brewing industry, even in the last 10 years, because we didn't have to consider how is pasteurization going to impact a hazy IPA? How is it going to impact this fruited sour? What are these other things that we need to worry about? And frankly, if we told somebody, oh, well, I'm going to make a hop tea, cool it down, carbonate it, and then put it on draft, doesn't that sound refreshing? Most people would have probably been like, that sounds dumb. At a brewery, I want to drink a beer. Why would I be drinking a hop tea? And it's like, oh, well, that's a very valid concern. And we just did not have the imagination to see where it could go.
Right. And I think that's an excellent point and something that you and I have also talked about of like the end of time illusion is like the way things are is the way they'll always be. And it's like, no, that's you can't even imagine what beer might look like in 5 years. Like you might have an idea and you can probably get pretty close on some things, but like who knows? Maybe in 5 years we'll have like powdered beer that we just add water to.
Oh, powdered peanut butter.
Yes.
Well, actually, funny that you should mention that. There is a company that is working on doing basically dehydrated beer so that it's kind of like, how soda machines work is that they get like a concentrated bag of basically sugar and flavor. And the water is just kind of put into it and is carbonated and it comes out of the soda fountain. And honestly, I think bottle Coke tastes a million times better than anything that comes out of the fountain because fountains are gross. But they're trying to figure out the same way to do that with beer. And a lot of that is because you're basically, if you remove the alcohol and a significant amount of water, you can create a machine basically that can dose more alcohol and rehydrate the beer basically. And so you can have a variable alcohol product. So you can have a non-alcoholic version of it, or you can have like, the most alcoholic blood orange IPA that you've ever had. It's something that, is a really cool idea, and it's because frankly, kegs are expensive to ship. But if you're just shipping a box and it's just going to get hidden and you've removed the water and the alcohol, you've made something much smaller and easier to ship and go. But it's kind of the same problem as we have with discussing Velcorin, is that you still need to have the equipment to then put it all back together. And it's cool. I mean, like, honestly, that sounds like a great way to also avoid microbes and address other things. But it's still technology that we're developing. So you could actually have what did you say just before I went on this very weird tangent? Dehydrated
Powdered
something,
beer.
powdered beer. Yeah. So it's like this is the closest that we've come so far to having powdered beer. And that's either a very unsettling idea or kind of like, ooh, I'm kind of curious how this is going to go, if this is going to be effective. I don't know if the company is still going. Maybe it was ahead of its time because, frankly, a huge part of having a business is timing.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I definitely agree with you because I can think of like several situations in which something like that would be a perfect solution. And then, other places like I don't need to buy a bag of concentrated Pilsner beer. I'd rather go to Pilsner and just buy the beer. But if I'm at a football stadium, and I'm like, I just know that I'm getting like 20 ounces of whatever, like, yeah, that seems like that would be a reasonable solution.
And also, I mean, frankly, having the option to just be like, oh, this can be alcoholic or non-alcoholic.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Such a great way, and that's such a great, cool way to be like, yeah, you can have the beer that matches your goals for the evening.
Yes.
And or I'm hoping evening. If it's matching your morning, then I hope you're a pirate. You're having a very good time. But yeah, it's when you really dive into where are we going with brewing and how are we keeping it safe? How are we relating, frankly, to other industries? Because we are now having to take lessons from them.
Right.
And at the same time, figure it out on our own, having our own fuck around and find out. I'm really looking forward to seeing, frankly, what kind of things we imagine up or can find that the natural world works with us. And maybe it's closer than we think. A huge thing that I've pointed out to a lot of people is that, we sit there and we say eat carrots because like that's a great way of getting beta carotene, but then you get all these other vitamins and minerals better absorbed into your system because they were all designed to be eaten together. It's all
Right.
packaged together to be efficient. So maybe we just need to find perhaps the right base. Maybe it's not malt, maybe it's not Kernza, maybe it's something in Africa or some kind of starch or sugar source that we haven't used yet. There could be something adjacent to that that's like, actually, we also take care of a lot of other problems.
Yeah.
I'm just always kind of curious because I think, and I think the best example I've ever seen of that is done in such an abstract perspective is watching the show Scavenger's Rain. It seems crazy how it's like, well, you get sick from this, but then this other thing from the planet heals you. And it's like, seems like magic. And it's like, that's literally how our planet works.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, great. Well, Francis, thank you so much for joining us again and telling us all about pasteurization. And if our listeners want to learn more about you and more about what you do, where can they find you?
Pretty much people randomly find me at conferences and describe my own work to me, which was really fun.
Oh, yeah. I love when that happens. Yeah.
yeah, this is what happens when I don't have pink hair is people literally don't recognize me. So I own Firmly, which is a QAQC lab. I am a TTB certified chemist. What that means is that I had to provide that I have the education and knowledge to be able to actually understand what I'm testing and the results that I'm giving people. And I also am a process authority considering the work that I've done in pasteurization, the paper that I wrote and my continued work in education. I'm very passionate about this. I did a presentation for the ASBC, I think in 2022 on this as well. This was a lot more fun. Then I also do a lot of freelance writing, and you can find other things that I've written about. I have one out there that's Clean Fight Club. It's how to do understanding your cleaning chemicals from a, but it's all written like it's a Fight Club. I can't, it's not going to have Brad Pitt riding around mostly shirtless, but
Hey.
it's a good time.
Right.
And honestly, I mean it, I'm very passionate about making sure that great beers go out there, but I'm also really care about making sure that we understand and pay homage to the origins of this amazing industry because it is not, we are able to do research, we are able to understand, we are able to talk across the entire world, and there is no reason why we should just be centered on this one Eurocentric narrative anymore. We
Right.
have an entire world of fermentation, and the opportunities there are endless.
Excellent. I agree. Well,
Very
thank you
beautiful.
again so much for joining us. And you can find us, False Bottom Girls, on Instagram and Facebook at False Bottom Girls. You can email us, falsebottomgirls@gmail.com, and you can visit our website, falsebottomgirls.com.
This has been False Bottom Girls,
and we make the brewing world go round.